Chapter 89. Itself legalized in 14 states in spite of the opposition of the physicians, that it has established 20 osteopathic schools and colleges, that among its students are 75 allopathic physicians, that there is a school in Boston and another in Philadelphia, that there are about 100 students in the parent college Dr. Stills at Kirksville, Missouri, and that there are about 2,000 graduates practicing in America. Dear me, there are not 30 in Europe. Europe is so sunk in superstitions and prejudices that it is an almost impossible thing to get her to do anything but scoff at a new thing unless it come from abroad, as witness the telegraph, dentistry, and see, presently the osteopath will come over here from America, and will soon make himself a power that must be recognized and reckoned with. And then, 25 years from now, England will begin to claim the invention, and tell all about its origin, in the Cyclopedia B- as in the case of the telegraph, applied anesthetics and the other benefactions which she heaped her abuse upon when her inventors first offered them to her. I cannot help feeling rather inordinately proud of America for the gay and hearty way in which she takes hold of any new thing that comes along and gives it a first-rate trial. Many an ass in America is getting a deal of benefit out of ex-science's new exploitation of an age-old healing principle, faith, combined with the patient's imagination, let it boom along. I have no objection. Let them call it by what name they choose, so long as it does helpful work among the class which is numerically vastly the largest bulk of the human race, i.e. the fools, the idiots, the pudheads. We do not guess. We know that 9 in 10 of the species are pudheads. We know it by various evidences. And one of them is, that for ages the race has respected and almost venerated the physician's grotesque system, the emptying of miscellaneous and harmful drugs into a person's stomach to remove ailments which in many cases the drugs could not reach at all, in many cases could reach and help, but only at cost of damage to some other part of the man. And in the remainder of the cases the drug either retarded the cure, or the disease was cured by nature in spite of the nostrums. The doctor's insane system has not only been permitted to continue its follies for ages, but has been protected by the state, and made a close monopoly an infamous thing, a crime against a free man's proper right to choose his own assassin, or his own method of defending his body against disease and death. And yet at the same time, with curious and senile inconsistency, the state has allowed the man to choose his own assassin in one detail, the patent medicine detail, making itself the protector of that perilous business, collecting money out of it, and appointing no committee of experts to examine the medicines, and forbid them when extra dangerous. Really, when a man can prove that he is not a jackass, I think he is in the way to prove that he is no legitimate member of the race. I have by me a list of 52 human ailments, common ones, and in this list I count 19 which the physician's art cannot cure. But there isn't one which osteopathy or Kellgren cannot cure, if the patient comes early. 15 years ago I had a deep reverence for the physician and the surgeon. But 6 months of closely watching the Kellgren business has revolutionized all that, and now I have neither reverence nor respect for the physician's trade, and scarcely any for the surgeon's. I am convinced that of all quackeries, the physician's is the grotesquest and the silliest. And they know they are shams and humbugs. They have taken the place of those augurs who couldn't look each other in the face without laughing. See what a powerful hold our ancient superstitions have upon us. 2 weeks ago, when Livy committed an incredible imprudence, and by consequence, was promptly stricken down with a heavy triple attack influenza, bronchitis, and a lung affected, she recognized the gravity of the situation, and her old superstitions rose. She thought she ought to send for a doctor. Think of it, the last man in the world I should want around at such a time. Of course I did not say no, not that I was indisposed to take the responsibility, for I was not, my notion of a dangerous responsibility being quite the other way, but because it is unsafe to distress a sick person. I only said we knew no good doctor, and it could not be good policy to choose at hazard. So she allowed me to send for Kellgren. Today she is up and around Lourdes. It is safe to say that persons hit in the same way at the same time, are in bed yet, and booked to stay there a good while, and to be in a shackly condition, and afraid of their shadows for a couple of years or more to come. It will be seen by the foregoing, that Mark Twain's interest in the Kellgren system was still an ardent one. Indeed, for a time he gave most of his thought to it, and wrote several long appreciations, perhaps with little idea of publication, but merely to get his enthusiasm physically expressed. War, however, presently supplanted medicine, the Boer troubles in South Africa, and the Boxer insurrection in China. It was a disturbing, exciting year. To W.D. Howells, in Boston. Wellington Court, Knightsbridge, January 25, 1900. Dear Howells, if you got half as much as Pond prophesied, be content and praise God it has not happened to another. But I am sorry he didn't go with you, for it is marvelous to hear him yarn. He is good company, cheery and hearty, and his mill is never idle. Your doing a lecture tour was heroic. It was the highest order of grit, and you have a right to be proud of yourself. No amount of applause or money or both could save it from being a hell to a man constituted as you are. It is that even to me, who am made of coarser stuff, I knew the audiences would come forward and shake hands with you, that one infallible sign of sincere approval. In all my life, wherever it failed me, I left the hall sick and ashamed, knowing what it meant. Privately speaking, this is a sordid and criminal war, and in every way shameful and excuseless. Every day I write in my head bitter magazine articles about it, but I have to stop with that. For England must not fall. It would mean an inundation of Russian and German political degradations which would envelop the globe and steep it in a sort of middle-aged night and slavery which would last till Christ comes again. Even wrong, and she is wrong, England must be upheld. He is an enemy of the human race who shall speak against her now. Why was the human race created? Or at least why wasn't something creditable created in place of it? God had his opportunity. He could have made a reputation. But no, he must commit this grotesque folly, a lark which must have cost him a regret or two, when he came to think it over and observe effects. For a giddy and unbecoming caprice there has been nothing like it till this war. I talk the war with both sides, always waiting until the other man introduces the topic. Then I say, why head is with the Briton, but my heart and such racks of morals as I have, are with the Boer. Now we will talk, unembarrassed and without prejudice. And so we discuss, and have no trouble. January 26. It was my intention to make some disparaging remarks about the human race, and so I kept this letter open for that purpose, and for the purpose of telling my dream, wherein the Trinity were trying to guess a conundrum, but I can do better, for I can snip out of the IMS various samples and sidelights which bring the race down to date, and expose it as of yesterday. If you will notice, there is seldom a telegram in a paper which fails to show up one or more members and beneficiaries of our civilization as promenading in his shirt tail, with the rest of his regalia in the wash. I love to see the holy ones air their smug pieties, and admire them, and smirk over them, and at the same moment frankly and publicly show their contempt for the pieties of the Boer, confidently expecting the approval of the country and the pulpit, and getting it. I notice that God is on both sides in this war, thus history repeats itself. But I am the only person who has noticed this. Everybody here thinks he is playing the game for this side, and for this side only. With great love to you all, Mark. One cannot help wondering what Mark Twain would have thought of human nature had he lived to see the Great World War, fought mainly by the Christian nations who for nearly 2,000 years had been preaching peace on earth and goodwill toward men. But his opinion of the race could hardly have been worse than it was. And nothing that human beings could do would have surprised him. To Rev. J. H. Twitchell, in Hartford, London, January 27, 1900. Dear Joe, apparently we are not proposing to set the Filipinos free and give their islands to them, and apparently we are not proposing to hang the priests and confiscate their property. If these things are so, the war out there has no interest for me. I have just been examining Chapter 70, Avaloing the Equator, to see if the Boer's old military effectiveness is holding out. It reads curiously, as if it had been written about the present war. I believe that in the next chapter my notion of the Boer was rightly conceived. He is popularly called uncivilized, I do not know why. Happiness, food, shelter, clothing, wholesale labor, modest and rational ambitions, honesty, kindliness, hospitality, love of freedom and limitless courage to fight for it, composure and fortitude in time of disaster, patience in time of hardship and privation, absence of noise and brag in time of victory, contentment with a humble and peaceful life void of insane excitements. If there is a higher and better form of civilization than this, I am not aware of it and do not know where to look for it. I suppose we have the habit of imagining that a lot of artistic, intellectual and other artificialities must be added, or it isn't complete. We and the English have these latter, but as we lack the great bulk of these others, I think the Boer civilization is the best of the two. My idea of our civilization is that it is a shabby poor thing and full of cruelties, vanities, arrogancies, meannesses, and hypocrisies. As for the word, I hate the sound of it, for it conveys a lie, and as for the thing itself, I wish it was in hell, where it belongs. Provided we could get something better in the place of it. But that is not possible, perhaps. Poor as it is better than real savagery, therefore we must stand by it, extend it, and, in public, praise it. And so we must not utter any hateful word about England in these days, nor fail to hope that she will win in this war, for her defeat and fall would be an irremediable disaster for the mangy human race. Naturally, then, I am for England, but she is profoundly in the wrong, Joe, and no instructed Englishman doubts it. At least that is my belief. Maybe I managed to make myself misunderstood as to the osteopathists. I wanted to know how the men impress you. As to their art, I know fairly well about that, and should not value Hartford's opinion of it, nor a physician's, nor that of another who proposed to enlighten me out of his ignorance. Opinions based upon theory, superstition and ignorance are not very precious. Livy and the others are off for the country for a day or two. Love to you all, Mark. The next letter affords a pleasant variation. Without doubt it was written on realizing that good nature and enthusiasm had led him into indiscretion. This was always happening to him, and letters like this are not infrequent, though generally less entertaining. To Mr. Ann, in London. Wellington Court, February 23, 00. Dear Mr. Ann, upon sober second thought, it won't do. I withdraw that letter. Not because I said anything in it which is not true, for I didn't, but because when I allow my name to be used in forwarding a stock scheme I am assuming a certain degree of responsibility as toward the investor, and I am not willing to do that. I have another objection, a purely selfish one. Trading upon my name, whether the enterprise scored a success or a failure would damage me. I can't afford that. Even the Archbishop of Canterbury couldn't afford it, and he has more character to spare than I have. Ah, a happy thought. If he would sign the letter with me, that would change the whole complexion of the thing, of course. I do not know him, yet I would sign any commercial scheme that he would sign. As he does not know me, it follows that he would sign anything that I would sign. This is unassailable logic, but really that is all that can be said for it. No, I withdraw the letter. This virgin is pure up to date, and is going to remain so. Is sincerely, S50. C. Terev. J. H. Twitchell, in Hartford. Wellington Court, Knightsbridge, MCH. 400. Dear Joe, Henry Robinson's death is a sharp wound to me, and it goes very deep. I had a strong affection for him, and I think he had for me. Every Friday, 3/4 of the year for 16 years he was of the billiard party in our house. When we come home, how shall we have billiard nights again with no Ned Bunce, and no Henry Robinson? I believe I could not endure that. We must find another use for that room. Susie is gone, George is gone, Libby Hamersley, Ned Bunce, Henry Robinson. The friends are passing, one by one. Our house, where such warm blood and such dear blood flowed so freely, is become a cemetery. But not in any repellent sense. Our dead are welcome there. Their life made it beautiful. Their death has hallowed it. We shall have them with us always, and there will be no parting. It was a moving address you made over Ward Cheney, that fortunate youth. Like Susie, he got out of life all that was worth the living, and got his great reward, before he had crossed the tropic frontier of dreams, and entered the Sahara of fact. The deep consciousness of Susie's good fortune is a constant comfort to me. London is happy-hearted at last. The British victories have swept the clouds away, and there are no uncheerful faces. For 3 months the private dinner parties we go to, no public ones, have been lodges of sorrow, and just a little depressing sometimes. But now they are smiley and animated again. Joe, do you know the Irish gentleman and the Irish lady, the Scotch gentleman and the Scotch lady? These are darlings, everyone. Night before last it was all Irish 24. One would have to travel far to match their ease, and sociability and animation and sparkle and absence of shyness and self-consciousness. It was American in these fine qualities. This was at Mr. Leckie's. He is Irish, you know. Last night it was Irish again, at Lady Gregory's. Lord Roberts is Irish, and Sir William Butler, and Kitchener, I think, and a disproportion of the other prominent generals are of Irish and Scotch breed, keeping up the traditions of Wellington, and Sir Colin Campbell of the Mutiny. You will have noticed that in S. A. as in the Mutiny, it is usually the Irish and the Scotch that are placed in the forefront of the battle. An Irish friend of mine says this is because the Celts are idealists and enthusiasts, with age-old heroisms to emulate and keep right before the world, but that the low-class Englishman is dull and without ideals, fighting bulldoggishly, while he has a leader, but losing his head and going to pieces when his leader falls. Not so with the Celt. Sir W.M. Butler said, the Celt is the spearhead of the British lance. Love to you all. Mark. The Henry Robinson mentioned in the foregoing letter was Henry C. Robinson, one-time governor of Connecticut, long a dear and intimate friend of the Clemens household. Ecke was W. E. H. Leckie, the Irish historian whose history of European morals had been, for many years, one of Mark Twain's favorite books. In July the Clemenses left the small apartment at 30 Wellington Court, and established a summer household a little way out of London, at Dollis Hill. Today the place has been given to the public under the name of Gladstone Park, so called for the reason that in an earlier time Gladstone had frequently visited there. It was a beautiful spot, a place of green grass and spreading oaks. In a letter in which Mrs. Clemens wrote to her sister, she said, "It is Gutenberg edition." End of chapter.